you very much for coming. Welcome back to the South Asian Seminar at the Institute of South and Southeast Asian Studies. I'm Eva Hussein, a teacher of politics and international studies. We're very, very pleased today to welcome Dr. Michael Bühler here. Dr. Bühler is senior lecturer in comparative politics in the Department of Politics and International Studies at SOAS. He's an associate research fellow at the Asia Society in New York. He has taught at Columbia and Northern Illinois University, as well as holding fellowships at Northwestern, the KITLV, and other places. He's the author of a number of articles and book chapters on Sharia, democracy, and politics in Southeast Asia, and his book, The Politics of Sharia Law, Islamist Activists and the State in Democratizing Indonesia, was published by Cambridge University Press last year. Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I actually just ran here from the train station. I was teaching at SOAS until about 2 hours ago. And so on the way from the train station to here, my notes fell into a puddle. And so I'm going to probably give you a bit of a watered down version of the talk. But I try my best and want to just give you a brief overview over the research I've done over the last couple of years, and then probably, if we have time, also tell you a bit about what the research is that I'm doing right now, which is sort of related to what I'm talking about here. Now, it's the South Asian seminar series, so I'm not sure how familiar you are with Southeast Asia and Indonesia in particular, so I thought I'll just have a quick introduction into the relationship between Islam and Indonesia, because it is actually quite unique compared to other Muslim majority countries. I think what's important first to understand for my story is that basically Indonesia is the largest Muslim majority country in the world, so there's more or about as many Muslim living in Indonesia than in the entire Middle East combined. However, it is a country that is actually based on a secular constitution or an ecumenical constitution. So Islamic law is not the basis of the Indonesian constitution, unlike in neighboring Malaysia, for instance, right? And so how did this come about? We basically had a constitutional debate when Indonesia became independent in 1945. And a group that were basically secular nationalist in outlook won in that debate and basically managed to eradicate the so-called Jakarta Charter from the Indonesian constitution. The Jakarta Charter is usually referred to basically a preamble to the Indonesian constitution, which basically said every Muslim needs to adhere to Islamic law in Indonesia. So if that would have stayed in the constitution, it would have essentially turned Indonesia into an Islamic state or a state based on Islamic law. But basically that was eradicated or deleted from the constitution. And so ever since, Islamist forces in Indonesia have used that as a rallying cry, you could say, to push for a state based on Islamic law. But what we have in Indonesia, again, important as a starting point, the Muslim majority, the largest Muslim democracy in the world, that is basically based on a secular constitution. We also then had a military dictatorship in power in Indonesia that came into power in 1965 and basically stayed there for 32 years, basically then collapsed in the context of the Asian financial crisis in 1998. But, and this is important as well, had a strong secular outlook, oppressed political Islam for most of the time it was in power. And basically, if you look at the bureaucracy, this is important for the story later on, most people in the Indonesian bureaucracy are either military figures during the military dictatorship or bureaucrats that have a secular nationalist outlook. So we do have a secular regime, both with regard to its constitution, but then also with regard to the sociology of the state. I think that's what I'm trying to say here. Political Islam oppressed for most of the time in Indonesia. Became independent in 1945, and then 20 years later we have a dictatorship that basically keeps political Islam at bay until 1998. So this has given rise to a couple of readings or articles and works, the most influential probably by an anthropologist called Robert Hefner, teaching at Boston University, where he basically talks, and this is the title of his book, of Civil Islam. He basically says that in Indonesia, the kind of Islam that we see in politics is actually quite syncretist, and it has so-called democratic outlooks, it is inclusive, and we basically have a Muslim middle class in Indonesia that emerges in the 1980s that actually pushes for democratization. So unlike these kind of old boring discussions whether Islam is compatible with democracy, Hefner basically in 2000 wrote an influential book where he said actually it was Islam and a Muslim dominated middle class that pushed for democratization under the New Order dictatorship. So about 85% of the country's 250 million inhabitants are Muslim, and basically civil Islam they practice syncretist beliefs mixed up with Javanese rituals, Buddhist rituals, Hindu rituals, basically has been a driver for democratization. Today, Indonesia, the third largest democracy in the world after India and the United States, and it is the largest Muslim majority democracy in the world. Okay, so again, important here, it has this image of being a tolerant, kind of inclusive Muslim majority democracy where basically Islam and democracy have shown that they are actually compatible. Now, this story in the last couple of years has, you could say, been undermined by various dynamics and developments in Indonesia. I just want to show you a couple of newspaper articles from the last couple of months. You could find this, although back until probably 1998, but we, for instance, now have, and this is all the international press, Bangkok Post, reporting about or on laws that basically want to introduce virginity tests for schoolgirls, so you basically need to go undergo a physical exam if you want to basically enroll in schools in certain parts of Indonesia. We also have then Reuters, for instance, that talks about how certain parts of Indonesia have become very exclusive with regards to sexual minorities. Aceh, the northwestern part of Indonesia, now has introduced a penal code where same-sex relationships are basically punished. We also then have the persecution of religious minority. The Ahmadi community is a sizable community in Indonesia. We also have a sizable Shia community. There's actually more Shia in Indonesia than there are Muslim in the United States in total. So because it's such a great, a huge country in terms of population, all these minorities are actually sizable minorities. They are now being persecuted by local politicians. And what you see here is that more and more so-called Sharia laws, as they are called in Indonesia, basically come up against religious minorities, sexual minorities, women. We also have the penal code becoming more Islamized, that we have now a bill that allows stoning in certain parts of Indonesia as a form of punishment. And then also the more absurd or funny here, that in certain areas of Indonesia, if you're caught dating after 9 p.m., you basically have to marry on the spot. And so there has been a couple of incidents where teenagers, having been caught being outside after 9 p.m., basically then had to marry that very evening, and basically, again, sort of basically an Islamization of Indonesian political and public life, people have said, right? And so basically what we see here is something that does not really fit with this narrative of Indonesia being this kind of tolerant, open-minded Muslim majority democracy. And then, of course, we also have increasingly now ban of consumption. So alcohol is being outlawed in Indonesia. All sorts of social activities that were actually just quite fine a few years ago are now basically rendered illegal across the archipelago, right? Okay, so the standard narrative of why this happens in Indonesia is that this has something to do with the rise of Islamic parties. So basically we see an Islamization of political and social life after 1998, as I just pointed out, and basically people have said that this is a creeping Shariaization that we see across Indonesia. Again, to just give you an indication of how big the country is, if you would basically put it on a European map, One part of Indonesia, the westernmost part, would be in Dublin, and then the easternmost part would be in Tehran, right? So a huge country, and basically people say that Islamization is something we see across the archipelago, right? They also say this has something to do with Islamist parties that basically have now taken advantage of the political opening after 1998 and basically have used their political position in formal politics to push for an Islamization of Indonesian public and social life. This has also fed into this narrative of Southeast Asia being the second front in the war against terror. George W. Bush basically said more sources should be concentrated in Southeast Asia because that's really where we see the new kind of war against terror, terror materialize, and this is basically a result of transnational jihadi networks as well. And what we see in Indonesia is essentially the Arabization of Indonesian politics as well, right? Now, there's many empirical conditions or facts that basically do not align with this kind of standard narrative, right? The first, this is just emblematic of the discussion, you basically have these secular politicians on stage that basically say, as you can see here, welcome to democratic, progressive and secular Indonesia, guarded by military figures, right? But then under the stage you have these dark, sinister-looking, turban-wearing Islamists that basically hold up this banner, Sharia law now. This was the cover page of the Far Eastern Economic Review, where Sandanan Doom, a conservative commentator in Washington, D.C., basically said more military aid should be given to Indonesia to fight against these transnational jihadi groups that basically Arabize Indonesian politics. Right now, as I said, many developments on the ground that basically do not align with this narrative. The first you can see here quite clearly. If you look at Islamist parties, basically parties in Indonesia that say they want to establish a state based on Islamic law, there's just four. And they actually have revised their agenda since. But if you look at parties in 1998 and you study their political party platforms, you basically see that there are four parties that have said, we need to establish a state based on Islamic law. The PPP, the PKS, the PPNUE, and the PPP, or the PETIGA, as it's called in Indonesia. What you see here immediately is that basically the combined vote figures for these parties have not really changed over the last two decades, right? So if we take the elections in 1999, a combined vote a total of about 14.64%, and then in 2014, the last elections we have seen in Indonesia, about 14.78%. So basically, Islamist parties have not become more influential, right? So this narrative that we see a strengthening of Islamic parties, therefore then an Islamization of Indonesian politics, does not align with these electoral figures here, right? Also important is that basically this narrative that this is a phenomenon we see across the archipelago is also not true. There's actually tremendous variance within Indonesia with regard to what kind of laws are adopted and where they are adopted. So what you see here is basically a map of Indonesia, and the greener provinces, the more Sharia laws they have adopted, right? And so this narrative that we see a creeping Shariaization of Indonesia across the archipelago does not align with these empirical data that I have collected and then basically published in this article together with Elizabeth Pisani, who is also working on Indonesia. What we basically see here is that there are six clusters where Sharia laws basically are concentrated. We have Aceh, which is here in the western part of Indonesia. We have West Sumatra. As you then go down and go into Java, we have West Java, East Java, South Kalimantan, and then here that would be South Sulawesi. Okay, so that's where probably about 60% of all these laws are actually concentrated, yet just about 23% of all Indonesian districts you can actually find in these areas, right? So a tremendous concentration of Sharia laws in a very small number of districts and provinces. So the puzzle really is that I thought needs to be explained is why do we see, or how should we explain this adoption of Sharia regulations despite the decline of Islamist parties, or the stagnation, you could say, of Islamist parties? I called it the decline because a lot of these Islamist parties have actually given up their party platform because they have not been able to win in elections, so they have basically abandoned these platforms and have become more moderate. Still can't win, okay? And then why do we see this variation? How do we explain this subnational variation in the adoption of Sharia laws, okay? So, for most of the time during my research, I was actually just out there collecting these laws because they're not really collected in Jakarta. So you need to actually travel to all these districts. An incomplete data set, but still the most comprehensive data set available on Indonesian Sharia laws. There's about 443 laws out there. And as I said here, about 67.5%, so almost 70% of these laws actually just cluster in about six provinces, where you basically have about 23% of all these districts. So Sharia law, the adoption of Sharia law in Indonesia, is a subnational phenomenon, and it basically is just very concentrated in certain parts, okay? So I basically went to these six clusters and tried to find out what is going on. How could we explain concentration? And so basically what you see is that in these six areas, you have a very distinct history. So you go back to the 1940s, you can even go back to the 1930s, and you will basically see that in these six areas, we had a very distinct class constellation, okay? We basically have, on the one hand, an aristocracy that basically has become powerful during the colonial period. They basically control the local state. They are aristocrats. They are the Andi in Makassar, in South Sulawesi. They are the Menak in West Java, for instance. They are the Hule Bangan in Aceh. But they are all from aristocratic origin and basically have been co-opted by the colonial enterprise and are basically populating the lower rungs of the colonial state. They then become governors and district heads once Indonesia becomes independent. Okay, so that's the one group, you could say. You have another group then that consists of rich rice traders and landowners that have become influential and powerful, so they are wealthy. It's like the nouveau riche, you could say, the bourgeoisie, that basically is wealthy but has no political rights. They are excluded from politics. Increasingly, it's this group that feels basically drawn to political Islam, because political Islam preaches a message of meritocracy. It basically says you should be able to participate in politics irrespective of your class background. So even if you're not an aristocrat, you can basically participate in politics. And so in these areas, we have these groups like Muhammadiyah, but then also Nahdlatul Ulama, who actually become very powerful in the 1920s, 1930s, and then in the 1940s, okay? Important as well is that actually these Orthodox Islamic organizations become so powerful that small groups within these organizations basically start rebellions against the state. So all these Sharia clusters basically are the site of Islamic rebellions in the 1940s and the 1950s, where you have groups of nouveau riche, you could say, that basically are affluent landowners that use Islam to rally against the state and for more political inclusiveness, right? All these rebellions, they're usually referred to as the Darul Islam Rebellion, and are basically squashed by the Indonesian military. The first in West Java is over by the 1950s already, and then in South Sulawesi, the rebellion goes on until the 1960s, around 1965. But basically, that's when they are officially over, okay? Now, for the last 30 years, we basically thought that these rebellions basically were eradicated, and with it, these networks that basically were the basis of these rebellions, right? We thought that because during the New Order period, the military dictatorship, it was extremely difficult to find out what is actually going on at the local level. So a lot of these groups, it seems, have actually survived. They were just driven underground during the New Order. So they did not disappear, but they basically managed to stay intact over the last 32 years, okay? And so basically what I did in my research, I tried to track these groups from the 1940s until today. There's mosque networks, for instance. There's all sorts of reports that have come out by scholars that are interested in terrorist activities in Indonesia. Sydney Jones, for instance, would be a famous scholar who has looked at these groups for almost 20 years. And so it's relatively, it's not easy, but you sort of can track a lot of these groups back to the 1940s. And so what we see is that a lot of these groups now re-emerge in democratic Indonesia. So they basically are underground for 32 years, but in 1998, when Indonesia becomes more democratic, these groups become more visible and more vocal in politics, okay? You, if you have followed Indonesian politics recently, have heard of these groups. They are tremendously influential in local politics because they can mobilize people, as you see here. This is a group called Forum Pembela Islam that is mainly active in West Java, that is able to mobilize thousands of people within a couple of hours, which Indonesian parties are, for instance, unable to do, right? Because they do not have any grassroots networks. We also have groups like GARIS, Gerakan Reformis Islam, which is a group that's active in Banten province, which is also quite influential because they engage in what is called in Indonesia sweepings. They basically go around and check whether local stores are selling alcohol or whether they actually serve as hangout places or places where people socialize that shouldn't be socializing. And we also have the KPPSI, which is the probably best organized pro-Sharia group in Indonesia that's mainly active in South Sulawesi, and again, direct links to these Darul Islam rebellions in the 1940s. Actually, the leader of KPPSI is the son of the Darul Islam leader in the 1940s in that very province. So very often these groups are essentially family networks that have survived over the last 40 years and now make a comeback in democratic Indonesia. Okay, so the puzzle then really is, or the question that I came up with then is, or that I wanted to answer is, why have Islamist parties that mobilized at exactly the same time as these groups in 1998 been uninfluential in politics, while these groups have actually become very influential in politics, right? So what we basically have is two sorts or two kinds of political activists, Islamist parties, Islamist movements, okay, that basically have the very same agenda. We want to have a state based on Islamic law. However, Islamist parties are not successful. If they would be successful, we would see a very different pattern. We would see Islamization across Indonesia. We would see it at the national level as well. We do not see that. We see it in areas where these groups are powerful and have a historical kind of basis, right? So what explains this difference? And so basically the answer or the hypothesis I came up with is that it's not enough to just look at these actors, but you also need to look at what is actually happening inside the Indonesian state, okay? And so my argument basically is that dynamics within the Indonesian state define and facilitate the Islamization of politics in Indonesia and explain why Islamist movements but not Islamist parties have gained power, okay? So what I'm essentially arguing is that elites that are dominating the state in Indonesia mediate the influence of Islamist groups. They, for some reason, keep Islamist parties uninfluential and for some reason have allowed these groups that are not aligned with Islamist parties to become influential, okay? So, the first hypothesis you could say, or a first counter-argument you could say, well, for some reason, perhaps these groups have become influential in formal politics. They have basically managed to co-opt the local state in areas where they are powerful historically, right? So what I basically did is I went to these areas and collected CVs of electoral candidates that have been running in these areas for governor or district head since 1998. In Indonesia, everyone who runs for executive government office needs to submit a CV to the local election commission. It's a standard form where you basically have to fill out your career, data on your career over the last 20 years, and you need to back that up with official documents. So you can actually establish a sociology of the state by looking at these CVs. And so I collected about 2,000 CVs, both of candidates that were running and then candidates that were actually successful in these elections, okay? So what you see immediately here is that most people in Indonesia, or most candidates, both the candidates that are running, but then also the candidates that are winning, are basically bureaucrats that have entered the Indonesian bureaucracy during the New Order military dictatorship. So these are people that have nothing to do with Sharia Islam. In fact, they were actively suppressing Sharia law for the last 32 years, right? And so basically, what now makes these very figures that for the last 32 years were like staunch, like military dictatorship bureaucrats, suddenly people that are actually quite receptive to an Islamist ideology and the push from below? What you also see is still lots of military people in the Indonesian bureaucracy, as we would expect. These are just two provinces, but I did it for all the six clusters, okay? And then basically, people from within society, so basically people that would be journalists or NGO activists, are very, very poorly represented in the Indonesian state, okay? And you could also say people from Islamist groups, of course, are therefore also poorly represented inside the Indonesian state. So the bottom line is you basically have old elites that keep populating the Indonesian state. So if you look at the sociology of the Indonesian state, it's still the very figure that came into power during the New Order dictatorship. So this is the deep state in Indonesia, you could say. Nothing unusual, right? But so this counter-argument that we see an Islamization in Indonesia because you have Islamists that now are district heads and governors is not supported by empirical facts. So we have basically a continuation, old elites are still in power, but, and this is very important for my argument, the power dynamics between these elites have changed, okay? During the New Order period, if you wanted to be a district head in Indonesia or a governor, you basically needed to schmooze up to the people above you. You basically needed to channel as much money as you could to people in Jakarta, because district government heads in Indonesia were appointed by the national leadership, okay? So what you did is you basically made sure that people above you in the hierarchy know about you and know that you have channeled resources in their way. That's how you got into power, okay? Now, in democratic Indonesia, which is now democratic and decentralized, you basically rely now, or you depend on the support of ordinary Indonesians. So what we really have seen since 1998 is a shift downwards and outward in the political system, okay? And so basically old elites still in power, but they now have to compete for power in a very different kind of fashion. So what you basically see here is, based on election data I collected, the number of effective candidates in Indonesian districts, just for this one province, but I did it for all the provinces in Indonesia. What you see here basically is if the number is lower than two, you basically have an electoral district or an election where there's no competition. So basically someone dominates this local election. What you see immediately here is that basically all elections or most elections in Indonesia at the local level are competitive, okay? So to summarize, what we see is old elites that are now forced to compete for power in a different fashion. They compete against one another, which was not the case before. They now need to mobilize hundreds of thousands of people to basically stay in power or to get into power. Again, to just give you a figure, West Java province alone has 45 million inhabitants, right? So these are sizable electoral districts, and you cannot meet every single person. It's a mass democracy. So you now need to find ways to organize the electorate, right? Because you depend on vote brokers and power brokers and vote getters to basically win these newly competitive elections. So this has been quite a shock to these new elites that basically for the last 32 years could rely on cozy relationships to people above them in the hierarchy. Now they're competing against one another, okay? And so basically secular state elites, okay, these are not Islamists, these are military figures and bureaucrats continue to dominate the state. However, there's competition now and tremendous pressure to mobilize and structure the electorate because you have a mass electorate that you're facing, okay? So I argue that it's exactly these changing power relationships that explain for why these figures have become receptive to these Islamist groups, but not to these Islamist parties. Remember, I tried to explain why these two groups that mobilized at the same time stayed inconsequential in the case of Islamist parties, but became consequential in the case of Islamist movements. And so basically I argue that these groups have something to offer in terms of resources to these state elites that these Islamist parties cannot offer. Okay? So the new power dynamics, the competitive power dynamics, the outward and downward shift basically makes them receptive to demands of groups situated in society. So these old elites now are suddenly confronted with society for the first time, right? And so basically now they are receptive to groups, but only if these groups can provide them with resources that help these elites gain and then maintain power, okay? So let's look at some of these resources, and this is sort of a summary of probably what Pierre Bourdieu has come up in terms of like political resources that are useful to politicians around the world. Okay, and so he talks of social capital, that networks are very important in mass democracies, that you need to mobilize people, you need to find ways to structure the electorate. Okay. You also need, of course, economic capital. As in any democracy, elections are tremendously, very expensive. Indonesia, still one of the poorest countries in the world, about 50% actually in Indonesia live on less than $1 a day. But if you want to compete in these local elections, you need millions of dollars, right? If you want to compete for an office in a resource-poor district in Indonesia, you need between 5 and 10 million US dollars for an election, just to have a chance, okay? So you need economic capital. You, of course, also need to have cultural capital. You need to be seen as a person that's electable, that resonates with the electorate, and so Pierre Bourdieu here has talked about how you need to basically have a certain kind of ideology, or at least to be seen as a certain kind of person if you want to be elected into office. Okay, so let's assume these are the three kind of resources you need. Islamist parties are very poor in delivering are very poorly set up deliver these resources. Islamist parties have no subnational networks. During the New Order period, Islamist parties, or any party in Indonesia, was not allowed to have structures below the provincial level. They were not allowed to mobilize people in between elections. There was this concept of the floating mass, that basically Indonesian voters are just floating around and are not aligned with any kind of party, and that just 2 weeks before elections, they basically align themselves with one party and then are voting for mostly the military-backed Golkar party, and then 2 weeks after the elections, they all sort of again disappear, okay? So there's no party branches at the subnational level, there's no money for parties at the subnational level during the New Order, with the effect that today most Indonesian parties are elite vehicles. It's basically the political vehicle of individuals. If that individual decides to leave politics, the party usually disintegrates very quickly. So we have a poorly institutionalized party system in Indonesia, okay? Because parties have no grassroots, they cannot support social capital. You cannot use parties to mobilize voters in Indonesia, okay? Second, they're also cash poor. Actually, Indonesian parties very often ask candidates to give them money rather than the other way around. So as a candidate for a certain party, you do not get party money to basically run an election campaign. You actually lose money because you need to team up with parties. The law says you need to have a coalition of parties, but that is a loss for most candidates, okay? And so basically parties are so poor in Indonesia and have no members that would pay any kind of membership fees or whatnot, that basically they are also unable to deliver economic capital. Finally, we have also parties very poorly positioned to provide cultural capital. Islamist parties in Indonesia, in the beginning, they're very ideologically inclined. As I said, they basically said, we need to have a state based on Islamic law. But over time, as they became more integrated into the Indonesian political system, There's something out there called the inclusion moderation thesis, right? If you include radical parties, they become more moderate, they move towards the center. But the center in Indonesia basically means corruption and all sorts of backroom deals and sex scandals as well, abuse of power. And this is exactly what happened to these four Islamist parties that I mentioned before. There were people jailed for corruption. There were sex scandals associated with party members. There's this joke that PKS in Indonesia actually now means the Partai Kotor Sekali, the very dirty party, because it's been involved in corruption and sex scandals. The bottom line is, if you align with Islamic parties, and there's some quotes in my book, you no longer actually have this kind of image as a pious candidate. In contrast, actually, if you team up with Islamic parties, very often people will make fun of you because they have such a bad reputation, right? So parties are not able to deliver cultural capital, okay? So Islamist movements, however, I argue, are actually able to deliver these resources. We have a network of mosques and boarding schools that are aligned with these Darul Islam networks that emerged in the 1940s. So again, I tracked, and colleagues did the same, some of these figures. After the Darul Islam was terminated by the military, they basically went underground, started boarding schools and pesantren and mosques, and basically are able to mobilize and integrate people every single week. There's tens of thousands of people that are channeled through these networks every week. There's Quran reading competitions as well that basically run along the lines of these mosque networks. And it's exactly these kind of networks that candidates use to mobilize people during elections, okay? They're also actually quite good in delivering economic capital. What I found out is that in certain districts, these groups have essentially established alcohol monopolies. So they basically say, you're no longer allowed to drink any alcohol in this district, but in this one hotel. And so I went to this one hotel and basically had a beer, and then found out that the owner of that hotel, who now makes a lot of money, is someone who contributes to the election campaign of the person who is running in local politics, right? And so these local groups are basically able to establish these protection rackets as well with regard to these sexual and religious minorities as well. If you pay, you basically are not harassed by them, right? And so they are actually quite good in delivering, or at least organizing, some of these illegal economies at the local level, and that basically brings money into the war chest, or the propaganda chest of these state elites. Okay, again, just to give you an indication here in terms of what kind of figures I'm talking about. In Makassar, I found a scheme where every bureaucrat, for instance, is now forced to pay a religious tax under a Sharia law, and the mayor basically told me that in an average month he makes between $300,000 and $400,000 just by cutting the salary of local bureaucrats through this Islamic law, right? And so a lot more money coming in through these alcohol monopolies and protection rackets as well. Then finally, these groups are also able to deliver cultural capital, because unlike these Islamist parties, actually these groups, for whatever reason, have managed to sort of at least be seen as pious Muslim and the hardliners that really mean what they say, right? Although most of them are actually semi-criminal organizations, the public perception still very much is that they are a lot more trustworthy when it comes to Islam and Islamic issues than these parties that have been entangled in all sorts of corruption and sex scandals, okay? Just to give you an idea here how it works in reality. So basically what it is, it's a form of machine politics in Islamic disguise, right? So what you see here is basically an excerpt, or a page from a book I found in a district, where basically the money that is made through these religious taxes is then distributed once a week to everyone who has a mosque, basically mosque teachers and religious boarding school directors, once a week, okay? So every week this is just one page, but there were about 100 more. Every week, basically, these people have to show up at the mayor's office, and then they get like £50 or something, and then they have to sign, or if the ones that can't write basically have to give their fingerprint to sort of confirm that they basically have received that money from the district head, right? But this is a form of, this is political bribes, and the social cosmetics to sort of make it more acceptable is that this is all done in the name of Islam, right? But this is how the money is then basically sort of first collected and then channeled to power brokers and vote getters in these districts. Every single person who, of course, runs a religious boarding school has hundreds, if not thousands, of people he or she can mobilize, right? And so this is a form of bringing them to your site, okay? So the conclusion is that basically in Indonesia we have, I think, the setup has not really changed all that much. So the state is still controlled by these secular figures, and then you have still these groups outside the state that fight for more political participation under the banner of Islam. What has changed is the relationship between these groups within the state, and as a consequence of that, basically, these state elites have become more receptive to groups that can deliver them the resources they basically need. So the broader kind of implications of that are that not all Islamist actors that mobilize are also able to influence politics. As the Indonesian case shows, parties have mobilized, these movements have mobilized at the very same time, yet just certain Islamist actors have become influential. So if you look at social movement theory, I think more research needs to be done on how and why movements actually become influential. There's a lot of research on why movements mobilize and how they mobilize, but there's not much research on how movements become influential in politics, okay? Also important, Islamist parties are not the transmission belt for an Islamist agenda in Indonesia, and I would argue probably in other countries as well. Very often, probably what we see in other countries is that basically you have Islamist movements that morph into Islamist parties. So if you have Islamist movement parties, maybe that is a way of a policy influence. But if you have a setup like the one in Indonesia, where these parties do not align with these movements, basically Islamist parties can be ignored as political players. Why is this important? Because until today, every single time there's an election in Indonesia, the New York Times or the Guardian looks at the election figures and basically says, all is fine in Indonesia because the Islamist parties are basically downhill, right? And that does not tell you anything. Vote figures with regard to Islamist parties does not tell you anything about the actual dynamics on the ground, because power is concentrated somewhere else. It's outside the party system, okay? And so finally, I think, again, we should look more at dynamics within the state, because as I tried to show in Indonesia, it is the state, these elites, that mediate the influence of Islamist parties. There's always then also this kind of research that says, oh, how many people are actually joining these Islamist movements? And in my account, that does not really matter. You can actually be quite a small movement, but if you have managed to occupy a niche that for some reason is actually conducive to power perpetuation by a certain kind of elites, then you become quite influential. These groups in Indonesia are actually quite confined in terms of membership size, because, as I mentioned before, most of them are basically built on family networks. So the question is not so much, are they becoming bigger or are they becoming smaller? How many people actually are in these Islamist movements? But I think the question really is, where do they stand in the political ecology of Indonesia? So it's much more about how they are aligned to state elites rather than their actual size. And so, of course, also important here is, and this we will see in the next couple of years, my bet is that if state elites find a better way to actually mobilize resources, they are probably just ignoring these Islamist groups, and therefore these Islamist groups may actually become as inconsequential as Islamist parties. So again, I think dynamics within the state are tremendously important to understand the Islamization of politics. So it's not just conditions and factors with regard to these Islamist players, but the broader kind of context that plays a role. Now, I've used up about 50 minutes. I could go on and talk more about what I'm doing now. Basically, what I want to do in the next few years is to look at the diffusion of these Sharia laws. So now that I've collected all of them, I basically want to look at how they spread across the archipelago by basically looking at the content and then come up with an idea of why certain laws are better at spreading than others. We see, for instance, that taxes, these zakat laws, are not very good at spreading across the archipelago, and then you have other laws that are actually very good. They're for some reason they are adopted more widely, right? And so what I did is I basically teamed up with Elizabeth Pisani, who is an epidemiologist, and so my idea was to look at this as if it were a virus, and basically then come up with an idea of why certain districts are, you could say, more receptive to these kind of laws than others, and why the virus, why certain types of this kind of virus spread more easily than others. And so I could show you some charts here, but maybe we look at this later on. But what you basically see is that it's really nicely aligned with electoral cycles, that basically if you run for re-election, then you adopt other laws than if you do not have to run for re-election anymore in Indonesia. Just a small short example before we stop. If you have these laws that are simply about improving your piety and the kind of ideology of Islam, then if you seek re-election, as you can see here, many more politicians actually adopt these kind of laws than the ones who can no longer seek re-election. So that shows really the political nature of a lot of these Islamic laws. If you run in elections, you basically want to be seen as a pious Muslim. If you no longer run in elections, you then probably go for patronage opportunities and try to squeeze out as much as you can from your district before you actually have to step down, right? And that's reflected in how these Sharia laws spread across Indonesia, in terms of the type of Sharia law, right? That's what I want to look at. What types are more conducive to diffusion? All right, thank you.